Welcome to Theology Simply Profound, a podcast of Reformed Forum. This is episode 210.
Colossians 3:12 says, "Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering." For Paul, this is how we are to live our lives as Christians. We are no longer to live according to lusts of the flesh, but now we are to live as Christ lived, in the power of the Spirit. It is no wonder, then, that the world often views kindness as weakness. Oh, sure, every Hallmark movie sets it up as a great attribute, but Hallmark movies have very little to do with reality. Sorry, Dad. The real world is dog-eat-dog, where the good guy finishes last. And there is some truth in this. Often those who are aggressive and are willing to stab people in the back are those who climb the corporate ladder and, in the eyes of the world, succeed. According to Paul, the same attributes that will get you ahead in this world are the attributes that are to no longer be lived by. Instead, we are to be loving, kind, humble, meek, patient as we encounter life. Does this mean that we shouldn't fight for ourselves at work? Does this mean that we are to live our lives as pushovers? Should we just be Amish? And what about Jesus using a whip to drive out the money changers? That didn't seem all that kind. We will discuss these and other questions today on Theology Simply Profound.
Welcome back to another episode of Theology Simply Profound. I'm Bob Terullo. I serve as pastor here at Westminster Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Indian Head Park, Illinois. And with me, as always, is Rob McKenzie. Rob's an elder here at Westminster. He's also a master's student at Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando. Howdy, Rob.
Howdy. Wow. Well, not getting many howdies around here. But
howdy. Yes, you, every now and then.
You have ridden Buffalo before, so you know, with the cowboy hat.
I've never ridden roping a bison. Doggies and, I have. No, I haven't done that
you
either.
Roped a dog? No.
No, never even, roped anything. I have watched things be roped. I went to a rodeo once. Okay. Yes.
And was there bow riding? Was there actual bow riding?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Did people stay on or did they fall off?
Both. They stayed on and then they fell off.
Did everybody fall off? Is that how you get off?
That's how you get off, is to fall. I'm sure there's a more technical way of putting it, but yes, they usually fall off, but gracefully.
I never knew this, but I was watching something that was talking about rodeos. And like, rodeos are huge. I did not realize how
in
like
some
the rodeos.
States, yes.
Well, yeah, but I mean, yeah. Just even nationally, mm-hmm. That it's a lot wider spread than I thought. That, mm-hmm. that rodeo is a thing, lots of people like they do the rodeo circuit. And I always knew that rodeos existed, but I always thought they were like in Texas, you know. And
well, they are in
Texas.
They're
like Renaissance festivals. That's how I grew
they're
up.
Definitely not.
Of them.
No, they are modern day things.
It's more like NASCAR.
I can't compare the two. I don't know.
Well, I don't really watch NASCAR either. That's more of a Southern thing, but at least.
Yeah.
But I know that of course, we do have the Chicago Motor Speedway that NASCAR uses over in Joliet, but that's South anyway. Joliet.
So. Well, it's south of us. I cannot say that would be Southern.
Joliet. It depends. You know, once it gets south of I-80, as we were talking about earlier, Chicago is a state unto itself.
Yeah. Well, some people would say that. Yeah. I mean, when I lived in New York, the thing was, you know, let's make New York its own state. That, you know,
but. Well, people in Chicago are always thinking we're actually a state unto ourselves, and the rest of Illinois is going, please be a state unto yourself, please.
So. I don't think I've lived here long enough to be able to claim one of those things one way or the either.
Oh,
so okay. I'll stay neutral on all things Chicago and Illinois. How's that? But
I don't know. You've been here long enough that you've had to pay enough taxes that I think you have some voice. But, we're pretty accepting here in Illinois. You can come in. Yeah.
Okay.
Of course we are. Well, you got to be convinced about that.
Not by the church.
Do you want me to slap you upside your head to convince you?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
How nice we are.
Give it a try, Mr. Kind Man.
I forgot.
See, that's the professional segues that we do here.
That's true. That's the kindness.
That's the kindness of Chicagoland.
Well, and that is, you know, as a Christian, the fruit of the Spirit produces a kindness within us.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's hard to then live amongst people that are trying to take your money all the time.
Yeah.
No.
Well, I mean, I don't find it hard to live among them, them and us. I don't know if I want to do that either.
What actually is kindness? Because kindness, it's interesting. The word in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word, I think, is chesed.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, you can't really translate that word. I mean, it's often translated as kindness, but it means, it's one of those words that if you actually listed what the definition is, which we're not going to do here, but it just kind of keeps going because you can't find the right term that really nails it.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going, covenant faithfulness is chesed, or and oftentimes loving kindness is, mm-hmm. is a terminology. Right. And King James, actually, if I remember correctly, translates this as loving kindness. Right? And so if you look at definitions for this word, you do get kindness, goodness, honesty as sort of synonyms for it. And Paul, for this particular word, when he says love is kind in 1 Corinthians 13, mm-hmm. Makes up his own new word for it. And using this same root, but he makes it a verb. Mm-hmm. Love is an act of kindness or showing kindness. It wasn't used anywhere else at that point. Paul makes that up to describe love, to make it an action. But here in Galatians, it's a noun. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, as a noun. Mm. And it's interesting that, you know, you get synonyms like goodness, and that's the very next word, right. in this list of the fruit of the Spirit. And so to get something definitional out of it proves challenging because we tend to use synonyms to get it. But in just doing some, you know, basic reading or even in just looking at the commentaries, you get a sense of it's an act of doing good. And good would be something as God describes. So it's an activity at least of some sort that describes God's ways, or that shows God's ways to others, showing goodness to others, you know, showing love to others. Kind
of, well, I mean, and that's, mm-hmm. that's one of the things we've had to deal with. Yeah. We're talking about the fruit of the Spirit is that they're all intertwined.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so kindness seems to be not necessarily a state of being, but something, you know, the person is a kind person.
Yeah, it's a doing.
Yeah, yeah. It's because of what they do. Mm-hmm. I've seen, when you look in the New Testament especially, that kindness seems to be often linked with forgiveness. That people who have sinned against you, that you are showing kindness to them in your forgiveness. They've sinned against you, but you're forgiving them. That in and of itself is an act of kindness. That Christ, when he takes on our sin, mm-hmm. and dies for us, it's a kind act.
Yeah. It certainly is, and that brings you to another place where kindness is used, and that's in Ephesians 2. And we already mentioned 1 Corinthians 13. You've mentioned the Old Testament, not strictly passage, but the language of Hesed, and Galatians 5, but also in Ephesians 2, the famous passage on the grace of God.
Right.
But that grace is described as a kindness. Mm-hmm. Just reading it, it says, but God, who is rich in mercy because of his great love with which he loved us, even when we were dead in trespasses, made us alive together with Christ. By grace you have been saved, and raised us up together and made us sit together in the heavenly places in Christ Jesus, that in the ages to come he might show the exceeding riches of his grace in kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. So there again, the use shows, at least biblically speaking, with regard to God and Christ, has to do with redemption, as you said, forgiveness, and it draws that out. The act of God forgiving us is a kind act. It is generous. It is love. I mean, so you end up using all these different synonyms, right? And these different words.
You can't actually define it.
I did find this interesting in the Tyndale commentary series.
Mm-hmm.
a couple of statements here. And if you don't mind, I just want to read this mm-hmm. out because I can't summarize this. And I'm not sure if it's all helpful, but I found it interesting. So in the Tyndale Commentary series, it references the Greek, which is Christestos. Mm-hmm. Christestos. It sounds like Christos, right? You get that? Kindness. Also has the connotations of goodness or generosity. But these thoughts are already covered by other words in the list before us. The common slave name, Christos, comes from this root, so that the word must suggest some quality that was desired in the ideal servant, as indeed do all the other qualities listed here. It has been well said that they are a list of slave virtues. It has been well said that they, I'm reading and I'm messing it all up, that they are a list of slave virtues. If these are the qualities of the servant Messiah on whom Christians are called to pattern themselves, this is not surprising. Indeed, there may even be a pun based on the similar pronunciation of Christos, the Messiah, and Christos, the slave name. Did the wits of Antioch intend this pun when they called this reformed sect of Judaism Christians, hinting at the goody-goodies? Right. So anyway, that was longer than I remembered it being, and I messed up there a little bit in the reading of it. But here the suggestion is the Christostes, I'm having a hard time pronouncing the actual Greek word, is a pun.
Right.
Referring to Christ and Christos. And I found that interesting. Well, you know, goody goodies.
The difficulty in trying even in defining it.
Yeah.
It's just something that, that at its core, you know, even in Greek, it's used different ways. Mm-hmm. It's kind of this very pliable word. There, you know, you can like Plato, you can make it stretch into all sorts of other different.
I thought you were talking about the philosopher at first. I'm like, wow, where are we going here?
Yes.
But you mean the play stuff?
Yeah, the actual play stuff. you can stretch it because it touches. To be kind is to be loving and to show goodness and mercy and forgiveness. And, you know, all these things are kind of mm-hmm. wrapped up into this word. It's an act of being. It's something that you are a kind person because of how you treat others. These are all a present in how you treat others. And as we're looking at Christ in his humiliation, the kindness of Christ to empty himself and take on humanity, to add becoming human mm-hmm. and living a life in this cursed world for us, and then taking upon himself our sin to then give us his righteousness. That is all an act of kindness. And we need to, you know, look, the Holy Spirit is producing this kindness within us. We too should be marked by this kindness. And so if this was a pun that's being talked mm-hmm. about, which would be fantastic, mm-hmm. the idea that you look at these Christians as goody-goody.
Right.
You know, aren't they just nice?
Yeah.
They're so nice people.
Right, yeah. Nice.
Right. They're so kind, you know, with that just kind of seething kind of, I hate the fact that they're so kind.
Yeah, well, and good, because they would do the things that no one else wanted to do because it was thought beneath them. Even, you know, and we're not just talking nobility and rich people either. Right. They would do the care, as we've seen, right, and you work through 1 Timothy, they would care for the widows. They would care for those slaves. They would care for people that weren't meant to be cared for in that culture, the way that, in a way that wasn't heard of. Mm-hmm. And that, as you said earlier, is this just some strange way that, that the world would look upon, mm-hmm. People doing God's things and say, I hate that.
Yeah.
But because the only way to succeed, obviously, is to be cruel, to be traitorous in the sense of betray others, stabbing people in the back, climbing over one another, willing to do anything in order to get one leg up, so to speak.
Yeah.
If that's the way of the world, then we should have none of it, right?
Right, right. And it's interesting that and I'm trying to figure out which one it was. I think it was Pliny the Younger, or maybe it was his father, Pliny the Elder, that was sent to kind of examine, like find out. Here, the emperor kept hearing all these horrible things about Christians, and there was great persecution going on about them. And so he actually sent out Pliny to kind of do an investigation. And Pliny writes back and says, look, these things that we've heard about these Christians, actually not true. In fact, they take care of widows. They're good. You know, they're good to each other. They're helpful. They pay their taxes.
They care for babies left, you know, to die. Right.
Yes. And now basically he was saying, yeah, I mean, you know, you might want to keep an eye on them. And if you want to persecute them, that's fine too. But you know, really you don't have to worry about them was kind of how he wrote back. But he was shocked because he had heard all these horrible, evil things. And Christ said, he told us, look, they've hated me while I've been here. I'm going to go away. Guess what? They're going to hate you even more. So we shouldn't be that shocked when the kindness or all the fruit that is produced in us from the Holy Spirit is exemplified in our lives to whatever degree that people in the world are going to look at that, see Christ and hate it.
Yeah, we are too often shocked and surprised when those who do good are shown the door or seen as undermining someone else or shown as doing something evil. Because we're told directly from Christ more than once that this would be the case. And yet, I mean, to a certain extent, it might show how good we've had it in the sense of living in a world, while we still live in the world, but living in a nation that has at least had a lot of blessings poured out upon it from God in the sense that there's been a lot of common grace throughout our nation. And that because there's been Christian values in one way or another for many years. And so when those things start to go away, or at least there seems to be much more divergence and open hostility toward Christ's ways, we tend to be a bit more shocked now, whereas brothers and sisters who have never been shown that kindness from political leaders or others have never had that blessing of living without that hostility. So now we're sort of getting a sense of a bit of hostility toward us, people calling us bigots or things of that nature.
Right. And it's just going to get worse.
Yeah. And just calling good evil and evil good. Yeah.
The question has to come up then. Do we then need to live our lives like wimps? Or should we just be pushovers? Should we be Amish? Where famously the Amish, if you walk up to them and start hitting them, they'll turn the cheek. They'll let you beat them up, and none of the other Amish people that are standing by will intervene. Is that how we're to live our lives?
Well, certainly not like Amish, because we disagree with them with regard to a lot of things. So I wouldn't use that as the place. I think, you know, an easier one would be, should we be pacifists, right? I mean, is in the sense of do we not believe in self-defense, right? And can we defend our families? We defend ourselves? Right. I think to one extent or another, I think it would depend on the situation, of course. That's a much bigger question, I think, because I do think Christians can be a part of military service and so on and so forth in that regard.
Right.
And you can defend your family if an intruder comes in. And so I think we believe in those types of things. Right.
The question is self-defense of country or family.
Yeah.
Or self.
The question is with regard to Christian conviction, will we willingly die for like being martyred, things of that nature. And I think we need to be ready to do that. And so just like reformers before us and others before us have been willing to do so, but can we run away from it at the same time? Yes. Paul does it at certain times. Sure. You know, if you can escape, right? But if you have to, then you have to. If you have to suffer, then that's what the Lord brings before you, and you do so well. Lord willing, I pray for the grace to do so. But to live as wimps, right? I mean, that's a pejorative way of putting it, right? But I think it's an honest way of putting it because that's how the world sees it.
Right.
Right. The world looks upon the weakness of Christ. Let's put it in those terms. Mm-hmm. Looks upon the weakness of Christ, his unwillingness to stand up for himself, right? Mm-hmm. That the world looks upon that and they see weakness, they see foolishness, mm-hmm. they see a wimp. Mm-hmm. Why would I ever follow a guy like that? Right? There's nothing in it for me, first of all. Second of all, he's a coward. He wouldn't even call down the holy angels, you know, if he had the power. Right. So, all right. So the world sees that and they look at it and then they just blaspheme, you know, as we would see it, because they see Christ as nothing more than a man who would not stand up for himself. And especially one who claimed he could. Right.
Right.
And so Christians, we have to have the mind of Christ in these things. And that does mean being weak in the eyes of the world, in my mind, right? And I know that there's going to be Christians who disagree with this, right? At various stages of what this looks like. But I do think that we must show ourselves to be willingly ridiculed as Christ was, willingly take on sufferings as Christ did. Not to save others, but to be as Christ. We don't do it out of a means to save other people, but to show the nature of love, a willingness to take on pain and suffering for the sake of Christ. This is for the sake of Christ, right? I remember a story that Bruce Hunt tells. Bruce Hunt was an Orthodox Presbyterian minister to Korea. And it happened to be during the time of the Japanese invasion, World War II, and he was imprisoned. And he regretted that he was imprisoned for being an American.
Oh, right, right.
He didn't want to be imprisoned for the sake of being an American. He would have been a much happier camper, in my language, if he was in prison for the sake of the gospel, right? Two different things there in my mind, as well it was for Hunt's. And I take that as a good distinction because he was there. I mean, if he was there as a soldier, then being in prison as a soldier is one thing, right? But he was there as a missionary, a soldier for Christ. And so he wanted, if he was going to be in prison, he wanted it to be for the sake of Christ, right? And so the suffering should not be for our sins or something of that nature, but should be for suffering for Christ's sake, right? So do we let people walk all over us? Well, that depends, right? If for the sake of Christ, yeah.
Right. So but we can still live our lives being kind to others, being kind as a way of life of showing and demonstrating kindness. Mm-hmm. In the workplace, in our home, in church, and when we're out at the grocery store, all of those things, we can do that without having to allow ourselves to be beaten up.
Sure, absolutely.
We can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, you don't walk up to someone and say, "Hi, I'm a Christian. Would you beat me up?" Yeah, you know, I mean, that's just silliness.
That's not what I mean.
No, I know that's not what you mean. But that's generally speaking, in the world we live in now, being kind is not going to give that cause, right, for someone to beat you up, right, or to harass you, generally speaking, right? So it's not that act of being kind that's going to cause that, at least here and now in the world that we live in Western society at the moment. That doesn't mean that won't change, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't mean being kind in other ways more generously Christian or explicitly Christian would cause that in future days or maybe now. But I do think that the sense of being willing to take on humility, right? And maybe this is a good place for a quote that I really enjoy from John Calvin. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, this quote doesn't come from his comments on Galatians 5, but come out of his comments on 1 Corinthians 13. And at the moment, I don't remember which word he's like reflecting on, but it's love in general. It has to do with one of the specific, you know, I don't remember if it's gentleness or patience or, well, that's what I'm meaning by that. But he says, love would rather be deceived by its gentleness of heart than injure a brother by suspicion. It is always ready to think the best, to put the most favorable construction on anything, right? So the situation that you're in, the content, you're the one who is willing to take sort of the brunt of it, mm-hmm. that, which takes a humility and a generosity of heart, a kindness, a kind act, to be willing to take it, so to speak, for someone else, to allow someone a generous thought before being suspicious about them in their behavior or in their life, to allow for the benefit of the doubt first and foremost prior to doing something unkind. To be really generous with your love, right. Essentially, I think is what Calvin's getting
it's
at.
It's really easy for someone that would say something to us or about us to immediately react with a tit for tat. It's natural. I feel it. It's somebody mm-hmm. somebody says something to you, and
it's a natural urge.
You want to just because part of it's you're defending yourself, mm-hmm. protecting yourself, and part of it is trying to get ahead of what's going to come next because if somebody says something mean against you or mm-hmm. to you, you know that, wait a minute, they're coming after me. This is probably not the only thing that they're going to say. They're probably going to keep saying stuff.
Right. Well, it's a defensive mechanism. Right. It's also an offensive mechanism, which is we want to be very careful about and not jump into a situation like that. I mean, the world teaches us misusing Moses, right? You know, an eye for an eye,
right?
And that's how the world wants to act. They want to say, right, you do something to me, I get to do it right back to you.
Right.
And you know what? It's not going to be just with another eye. It's going to be with a not equal force, but with a multitude of force beyond that.
Right. Well, we know because now I've got the righteousness on my side.
Yeah, that's a claim, yeah.
Right. You've come at me. Now it gives me the right to do something worse to you.
Yeah,
and not have any guilt over it.
Right, but what does Paul tell us that we should do? And when someone does this, it's not vengeance,
right?
But it's heap coals of what?
Well, fire on their head.
Yeah, right. But how? By showing kindness to them, and being gracious and merciful to those that would do us harm. Right. So the idea when we're harmed that we would not show a kindness back is an un-Christian idea,
right?
But we in the world that we live in are so susceptible to doing something different than that. Mm-hmm. And especially in the present moment we live in right now, which
tension is. Tension is high.
Tensions are high. Tensions are very high, politically speaking, which we are, you know, as much as we don't want to be, we're all in one way or another political creatures because we live in this country.
Absolutely.
And we think about the things to one degree or another. And race relations are high. And so there are, you know, you do this to me, I'm going to do this to you. And right, you have protesters and counter-protesters. And it just raises the tensions even higher. And Christians are so easily able to fall into that.
Sure.
And allow ourselves as patriotic people, if we are, to say, I'm doing this and out of love for my country. But we need to maintain a higher standard than tit for tat, as you put it, or eye for an eye. It is a standard that does not allow ourselves to be vengeful, because that is God who does that. Revenge is His, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. And so we have to really, really guard our hearts.
Right. I think what we have to remember is that it's not wrong for us to want to. See, it's a betterment in our jobs. We should be confident in our abilities. I think we think that if we're going to be humble and kind, and that then we can never, self promote in the sense that.
No, I hear you.
I'm really talented at this. I've got my degree. I've done all this. I'm going to go for this new job. And there's this pull on us that's like, oh well. That's self-promotion, and so therefore, mm-hmm. you know, must be wrong.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
There's nothing wrong with going out and trying to get a better job or seek a raise or anything like that, as long as we do it humbly and we're doing it in kindness.
Well, I mean, you asked about, you know, wimpiness and all that kind of stuff, and that gets to the language of humility a bit more as well. And I think some people think that humility and meekness tends to mean that you can't do well in a particular field and can't actually know that you do well. And therefore, because you do well and you bring something to a particular company that you can't offer those gifts and talents and ask for more and move from one job to another if another job will provide better for your family. That doesn't mean you're doing it for the purpose of gaining wealth or you're doing it for the purpose or a greedy purpose. You have to guard your heart about those things, right? We do need to think about those things. But, you know, to send your kids to Christian school costs money.
Yeah.
And some people might want to get a better job or a promotion in order to help provide for that and to be able to be more generous with other people or to the church they're a part of or to the deacons or to a particular ministry. So those things, if done with the right heart attitude, enable you to show more kindness.
Yeah.
And so the humility that comes that we have does not mean that we cannot be those that seek betterment for our lives, which might mean betterment for other people's lives, like your own kids or other family members or other people in the church. People are given a gift of generosity. Well, those that are given the gift of generosity have to have something to be generous with.
Right. Right.
and not put themselves into the need for asking for help. Right. So all of these things come balanced. All of these things come with wisdom. And you know, showing kindness does not mean stopping on the road for a hitchhiker that looks like he might be able to kill you. Right? I mean, that's unwise, right?
Right, right. No, I'm right. Yeah, that's a good point. And you know, that's why you passed me by when I was hitchhiking the other day. I saw that.
Well, no. Let me just say. So, I mean, this comes from a story. I remember driving from college. Mm-hmm. From my college to the church, and it was about a 40-minute drive every Sunday, right? We would do that. And along the road was, and it was a caravan of people, right? And along the road was a hitchhiker. And one of the Christians who was with us, you know, said, why aren't we stopping for him? Why aren't we stopping to pick that man up and give him a drive wherever he needs to go? I'm driving. I'm like, looking around, like, really?
Yeah.
I mean, first, well, it's illegal, right? You're not supposed to stop for hitchhikers. Right. It is illegal. At least where we were at the time. But he came from a context in a different country where it wasn't, and that the Christian thing to do was to pick up any hitchhiker. Mm. In America, that is not necessarily the Christian thing to do because bad things can happen to you.
Right.
Now, it doesn't mean it's necessarily something that you shouldn't do on occasion to given the particular circumstances,
right? This is just an example.
This is just an example, not a universal. But I was just like, that would not be kind to everybody in this car.
Not if they were murdered, no.
Of course not. But it wouldn't be, right. But you get my point, right?
Right. You don't, if you're driving with your family and there's a hitchhiker by the side of the road and you're like, I don't know. I need to protect my family. I don't know if I can trust this person. I'm going to move on. That is perfectly fine, because there's a whole number of variables that enter into
exactly.
That. You're at a convenience store and somebody's hit by a car. You call 911 and you see what you can do to administer as much first aid as you can. That's also showing kindness. It's not as if, hey, I wasn't involved in that. I wasn't the person hit. I wasn't the person driving.
I'm not my brother's keeper.
Yeah, I can walk away. No, kindness then, because it is an act of how we conduct ourselves in life, we go and we do whatever we can to help that person because that's the need at that time. It's interesting. I go back to part of what I was thinking when I was putting my opening together. When I was right out of high school, I mean, I had no money for college, and so I was working at a grocery store for a while to get some money so I can go to college. And while I was there, when I was hired, the boss said to me, now, when you're here for 2 months, here's your pay. You'll start out here, and in 2 months, you'll get this raise. And I said, oh, okay, great. So 2 months came and went, and I thought I'd get a raise, and I didn't. Another month went by, and I thought I'd get a raise, and I didn't. So after about 5 months, because in my thinking is I was promised this raise at this time, therefore I should get it at that time. And if because I hadn't gotten it, I'm still thinking I was told I would get this. It should be given to me. But I was I didn't think that it was my place to go and tell my boss, hey, I'm supposed to get that. I felt that would be too demanding. Well, finally, I went to him after 5 months, and I said, "You know, you had said that you'd give me this raise." He goes, "Okay, yeah, you'll get it now. You know, starting next week." And I said, "Well, you had said you were going to give it to me after 2 months. Why? How come I had to come in and ask?" And he said, "He goes, I'm not going to give you a raise unless you're going to be aggressive and go after it." And I walked away scratching my head. I was promised, you know. So the world works a different way. And in my, I don't know if I can, I don't know if I can call it kindness that I waited. I think it was, I wasn't angry. Confusion might have been the better word. Naivety, perhaps.
You're young.
I was young.
Yeah.
And so somebody promises you something, somebody gives that to you. Now I didn't get angry over that. I learned a lesson. And so I've learned, and it's against my, well, another thing I've learned is it's against my nature to want to go. If I'm promised something and then it doesn't come through, it just rips me up that I have to go and say, you promised that you'd do this. It's like, usually it's, "Oh yeah, I forgot." And that's usually what ends up happening. But I just, if don't tell me something if it's not going to happen. But when you're working in, and I've had several jobs in, in non-Christian companies, and I've worked also for Christian companies, I find a lot of times it can be the same in both when it comes to this business aspect of things. It's working almost antithetical to the idea of kindness within a work environment and how we're supposed to treat everybody. And I think that's why a lot of times for Christians, we hear how we're supposed to conduct ourselves in the world, and that leaves us kind of confused when we're in a work environment. Like, well, wait a minute, you know, the idea of self-promotion, the idea of looking for a raise, or even should I quit this job and get another job? It says, wait, no, I'm supposed to be content. I'm supposed to be content in all things. Therefore, I shouldn't go out and get a better job because I should be content. And I think that we struggle with that.
I think we do struggle with these things because it seems almost counterintuitive at times, content, gentle, but yet asking for something doesn't asking for something even sound some, isn't that violation of being content, right? Asking for content. But I don't think that is the case. And so even though we have these struggles, like I said earlier, with regard to kindness and gentleness, humility, these things do not prevent us from asking, right? And God asks us, tells us to pray, right? To ask for things. You don't have because you don't ask. So there's a sense in which, right? I mean, God wouldn't say that if being content meant you don't ask for things. We are able to ask for things, and especially if God has placed a good and righteous thing in our hearts for it. So that's, you know, we ask for wisdom. We're not to be content with just, you know, where we stay and our station and our holiness, our growth and grace. We want more of these things. That's not being content. It's being under the hand of God and being thankful for the things that God has given us.
Right. That's being content when we are not thankful for what we have.
Yeah.
Then we're not content.
Yeah. And so, you know, like I'm stuttering here. The way in which I was picturing in my mind what you were talking about, a job market, it's as though a job at a field, it's all competitive now, as though the work environment is one big competition, and everyone, all your colleagues and are all other competitors. And so that's why there's this spirit of antagonism and tension at one another. You're not necessarily where, maybe at one time, maybe I don't know if this is the case. At one time, there was a sense of cooperativeness in order for the company you work for to get to do better, so that everyone was lifted up, right? I don't know if that's accurate or not.
That exists in a lot of companies to a certain degree.
Yeah, but there seems to be competitiveness, and you want to see your colleague do better. Is a Christian attitude. To see your colleague do better. And so you do kindnesses to them, even in the workplace, right? And I think of the, like, even on a like a running event, right? Where, okay. where you've seen runners run and one guy falls.
Yeah.
And his competition stops to help him.
Yeah.
Right? That's an act of kindness that is selfless. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing. Whether it wasn't a necessary thing, because, you know, you're in a sport and that happens, right? Mm-hmm. But it was an act of kindness and it was a selflessness on the part of the person who stops and helps him up. That's a good thing to do, right? I mean, just to me, that's a good example of you know, a picture of kindness.
Yeah. Actually, scripture, I think a lot of people would think of I think one of the best examples that we have in scripture is Ruth. And not just Ruth, but Ruth and Boaz, and of course, the kindness of God. And Ruth chapter 2 demonstrates all three, the kindness from Ruth, the kindness of Boaz, and the kindness of God. And it's this selflessness, it's giving, it's helping people when, you know, above and beyond. Actually, why don't you read Ruth 2?
Okay, so this is Ruth 2, 1 through, how many verses? 23, 1 through 23. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him, in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem, and he said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, 'Please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers.' So she came, and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." Then Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping, and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." Then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me, since I'm a foreigner?" But Boaz answered her, "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. And how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Then she said, "I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants." And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine." So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain, and she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. When she rose to glean, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also, pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it for her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. And she took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw that what she had gleaned. She also brought out and gave her what food she had left over, after being satisfied. And her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi also said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." And Ruth the Moabite said, "Besides, he said to me, 'You shall keep close by my young men until they have finished all my harvest.'" And Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his young women, lest in another field you be assaulted." So she kept close to the young women of Boaz, gleaning until the end of the barley and wheat harvests, and she lived with her mother-in-law.
Yeah, so there's a lot of kindness in this passage. Boaz shows kindness to Naomi and Ruth. Ruth is showing kindness to her mother-in-law. The Lord is showing kindness by the fact that Ruth ends up at this field. You know, this just happens to be this particular field. And Boaz shows kindness to Ruth and Naomi, but also to Elimelech, as we see that because eventually we know that when Boaz marries Ruth, that child that's born is born and inherits the land of Elimelech. And so this is the kindness that Boaz is actually giving to Ruth and Naomi and even people he doesn't even know. I mean, who knows if they knew each other, but mm-hmm. but still, someone who's dead. He's showing kindness to people who are dead. That's a selfish act, and that's one reason why the nearer kinsman, as we find out later, did not take mm-hmm. Ruth as a wife because he didn't want to get his inheritance messed up, which was fine. I mean, he had every right to not want to get into that. So he allows Boaz to then marry Ruth. So we're given this great example of all these different people and how they show kindness to each other. And the Lord, how he shows kindness to us. And it's very selfless. Ruth is, what does she do? She leaves all that she has. Now, there's a conversion that's taken place here. And she wants to be in the land of Yahweh because she worships Yahweh. She's a righteous woman because of conversion. We know that has had to take place because she's demonstrating what the fruit of the Spirit. It still might be different than what's going on in Galatians or what Paul's talking about exactly. But I don't think it's that much different that Ruth is a godly woman. And her kindness is just how she lives her life. And Boaz, who are we given to? Who's he? He's a converted man. He's a worshiper of Yahweh. And what does he do? He lives his life kindly. Mm-hmm. And we see that demonstrated. And of course, again, the kindness of God that he would bring them together. Mm-hmm. Because here Boaz is an older man and falls in love. And Ruth, who could have, you know, she's young, she's beautiful, she could mm-hmm. have married many different people, but she marries Boaz. And even her marriage to him is a kindness. And so, there's no... it's not about, I'm going to pick these seven things that these are going to be my acts of kindness, as we always hear. This is a how do we live our lives? Well, whatever circumstances we're in, whatever situation we have to deal with, we deal with it kindly. Mm-hmm. Just to follow up in this study, let me recommend two books. One is called Unceasing Kindness, A Biblical Theology of Ruth. This is in the NSBT series, the Silver series. It's a very good book, really digging into Ruth and what's going on, what kindness means in the book of Ruth. The other one is actually by Michael Card, also an IVP book. Inexpressible is the name of it. Hesed and the Mystery of God's Loving Kindness. And what Michael's doing there is he's really looking at that word, Hesed, and seeing what it's trying to tell us. And because it just can't be translated as we would translate most words. So those two books, I'd recommend those. They're really excellent books.
Thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. We are found at reformforum.org. And if you would like to comment or let us know about anything, you can go do that by using mail at reformforum.org. And if you want to find out more about the congregation that Rob and I serve, you can go to westminsteropc.org. Or for more Orthodox Presbyterian churches in the Chicagoland area, you can go to chicagoreformed.org. What's up next time, Rob?
Well, next time we'll move on in the fruit of the Spirit to goodness.
Okay.
But also, you need to talk about Thursday.
Thursday. Oh, Thursday night is the Reformed Forum lecture. Let's just say that. So in lieu of the conference that Reform Forum typically has at this time of year, this Thursday, October the 8th, from 7 to 9 o'clock at Mid-America Reformed Seminary, Dr. Lane Tipton will lecture on the theme of Van Til's Trinitarian Theology, Reformed or Revisionist. Just clicking real quickly here to learn more about it, because I think that this is going to be live streamed, or I'm not sure exactly, or at least videotaped. So go to reformforum.org and click on the link to find out more about that, and maybe you can, you know, even look in on it.
I am pretty sure it's live streamed.
You're pretty sure it is? Yep. Yeah, I'm just trying to. Here it is. Okay. Yep. The event will be live streamed on YouTube as well as recorded for later viewing. So check that out. Reform Forum does have a YouTube page, and so a YouTube channel, I think it's what it's called. Mm-hmm. And so you can go there, and I'm sure that's where it's going to be live streamed. So check that out. All right. Thanks for taking the time to be with us on another episode of Theology Simply Profound. Until next time.